Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hi, you're listening to SupDoc Podcast. I'm Parker Romaine.
And I'm George Chen. And this is a show where we talk to interesting people with strong opinions about their favorite documentaries.
On today's episode of SupDoc, we review Smashing Machine, the 2002 documentary from director John Hyams that follows the MMA great Mark Kerr. I sat down to talk about Smashing Machine with comedian, musician, and Tony Award-nominated actor Stephen Lynch. So I'm here with Mr. Stephen Lynch, musician, comedian, actor, lover, dog owner, dog that pees on my foot owner.
I don't know what that was. You just brought it out in her.
I think you ordered it. I think that's how you intimidate your interviewers.
I taught her to pee on command just to mark my territory. I can't do it. That would be unacceptable socially, so I just have my dog do it.
In today's world, that is completely unacceptable. So we are talking about the Smashing Machine.
Ooh, I have not seen that.
You haven't seen that, Doc?
I hear it's good, but I haven't seen it yet.
It's great.
No, I have seen it. This is probably going to be... First of all, nobody's heard of this documentary.
Right, no.
It's impossible to find anywhere. It's not on iTunes or Netflix. I realized last night, I was thinking about it, I said, I have chosen the absolute worst podcast, the worst documentary for us to talk about on this podcast, because even if people hear this and become interested in it,
yes,
it's a pain in the ass to find. It is online, though.
It is online. That's
how
I watched
it, right?
Daily Motion.
Right. Yeah.
And you can, if you torrent, if that's your jam, you can
do that.
You can torrent this bitch.
You can probably order a VHS tape.
Oh, I'm
if
sure.
If that's your jam.
I bet you could probably pay Mark Kerr to come to your house and tell you about it at this point.
Yeah.
Because I think he's selling used cars.
He is.
Yeah. So if you fly to Phoenix, I bet he would help. He would get you at least a rental.
Yeah.
If you're going to be around in Phoenix.
He seems apprehensive about talking about this stuff.
He does.
Even though there was a big Sports Illustrated article about it like a few months ago.
I just
read it. Really great. And like a follow-up to this documentary.
Yeah.
And he seemed very open, but he did seem hesitant to talk about it.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, this is a guy that probably could have made much more than the $1 million that they were saying that he made.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, he missed the big boom. I mean, he was in the middle of the boom in Japan.
Right.
But then when that crumbled, he missed the big boom here, which we're sort of still in the middle of.
People love MMA stuff here in this United States of America.
Let me tell you something.
Tell me.
It's fucking embarrassing to be a fan of this sport.
Yeah.
It really is.
Why?
And I love it so much.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's just the greatest sport on the planet. And I've always loved that sort, boxing and Muay Thai and kickboxing.
Yeah.
Wrestling, I find I don't understand the rules of it, so I never got into it.
You mean like real wrestling or?
Yeah, like Olympic wrestling,
right,
or Greco-Roman wrestling.
Yeah.
I never quite understood it.
No.
So I never got into it. Boxing's pretty easy. You punch each other until somebody falls down or refs give the decision to the wrong guy. That's fine.
Right.
That happens every time.
Yeah.
But the culture around, specifically the UFC, is so... I never tell people that I like that stuff. I sit up here in my little room and watch this stuff like every week it's on like every few days now. And I rarely tell anybody about it. Because the first thing you think of is like, a new metal jam.
Right.
Fight, hit you with your fist. And like, a tap out t-shirt with some crazy skulls on it.
Of course.
And a bunch of dude bros.
Dude bros.
Who paint, just bleed on their chests.
Yeah.
And
that's philosopher bro. The guys that do that.
And God, it's just, I never want to admit to anybody, but it's such a beautiful sport.
But
it's one I love to
watch.
It's
also extreme. It's not like it's like hidden. That's huge, right? It has a huge popularity, correct?
It says that it's huge. I think it wants to be huge, but I you know, I don't have a big group of friends who all want to come over and watch the pay-per-view. I have a handful of people who sometimes want to watch fights, but it's usually only when they know who the fighter is. So it's going to be Ronda Rousey, or it's going to be somebody who, you know, has a who's dipped into the mainstream a little more.
Is who's that? Who's Ronda Rousey?
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. She's probably the most high-profile fighter in the UFC, and you don't even know who she is.
I don't. I have to admit, I don't watch UFC, WWE stuff. I was a big boxing fan in my 20s. I watched boxing a lot in the 90s.
Yeah.
But then that got stupid because then it was just heavyweight stuff, and now it's real stupid. I mean, like that Floyd Mayweather fucking fight.
Mayweather. All right, you don't even know Floyd Mayweather's name. Now I don't feel bad that you don't know who Ronda Rousey is.
Isn't she the one that just called out Mayweather?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, she gave him a jab for his domestic violence record.
Oh.
She beat him for Fighter of the Year at some like the ESPY Awards or ESPN, something or other. And then she said, I wonder how Floyd feels being beaten by a woman for a change.
Oh, snap.
Damn.
Ooh, she don't play.
And then they fought in a Walmart parking lot.
Yeah, over a case of Pepsi Light.
And put the video, somebody filmed it, put the video on YouTube, 40 quadrillion views.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because everybody would want to see that.
Well, now I understand why you picked this documentary then, because you're a big fan.
Yeah.
And you also.
And it's a great documentary, right? Because it's not just about the sport and not just about this guy who was a pioneer in the sport and one of the first, you know, legitimate wrestlers to sort of come in and take over the sport, because up until then it had been a lot of jiu-jitsu guys. You know, the Gracie jiu-jitsu family were the ones who started it to sort of plug their style of jiu-jitsu. And then he was one of the first wrestlers to come in and just, you know, it didn't matter how much technique you had. He was too big and too strong and too powerful.
The guy's a giant.
He's a giant.
He's a giant man. But what is he, 6'3"?
I don't know. He's definitely over like 6'1 or 6'2, but like a solid 270 pounds of just granite.
Yeah, he's a big, big boy with big ass legs and a big butt.
And you imagine those knees slamming into your face.
No.
You can't do that stuff anymore, by the way.
Gotcha. They changed in the documentary, Bas Rutten.
Yeah, Bas Rutten.
Bas Rutten, after Deutsche. Is he German?
Dutch.
Dutch, same thing. he said that they took his tools away on purpose. That Boss said that they took Mark's tools, which are what?
Well, he would headbutt. He would smash people's faces with his knees.
Great.
I guess the Japanese promoters at Pride wanted the fights to go on longer or something, and he was just mashing people in minutes.
Within minutes, right.
And so, I mean, that's a theory. I don't know that that's true or not.
Right. Sounds about right.
It's pretty brutal. You know, I'm not sad they took away headbutts to the face.
That's insane that there's at one point all of that was allowed.
Yeah.
And I think I was reading in the Sports Illustrated article that it's still allowed in Brazil. They still, it's whatever, no holds bar.
Kind I'm of. Sure they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there's a scene that was I actually had a look away in this documentary where he's talking about eye gouging and spreading your opponent's wounds even further.
Yeah, that's pretty gnarly.
And they show him taking his fingers and spreading apart this guy's face wound.
I know, it's so gross.
Yeah, it was like, oh, God. I had a look away.
I mean, his philosophy seemed to be, I don't want to hurt someone as much as I want them to just give up so the fight can be over as quickly as possible.
Take a shot. This one situation with two possible outcomes. You're either going to beat somebody's ass or you're going to get your ass beat.
Oh, what a headbutt.
And then the question you ask yourself is, how competitive are you? What lanes are you willing to go to try to win? You're going to poke him in the eye? Are you going to take your thumb and dig it and cut and pull it open a little wider? Of course you will.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. I mean, I went into this not knowing anything about this guy, and then the first thing you hear is, like, one of the first things you see is extraordinarily brutal. We were talking about this before we started taping. One of the first things you see is him just beating somebody, and then you hear his voice, and he sounds so sweet.
He's a soft-spoken guy. You know, he's intelligent. He can string words together to make a complete sentence.
Yeah.
Which, you know, goes against the stereotype of a guy who would lock himself in a cage with a 250-pound Russian guy
and
with no rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's very sympathetic.
Yeah.
And becomes more sympathetic, obviously, as the documentary goes on, because as we started to talk about, it's not as much about this blood sport as it is about this one guy who, because of the toll the sport has taken on his body, starts, you know, popping pain pills, eventually starts injecting narcs into his body. You know, he's clearly blown up on steroids.
Yeah.
I don't remember if they address that in the movie, but he, you know, it's pretty common knowledge that all those guys, this is before they did any sort of real testing,
right,
were all just, I mean, they're behemoths.
Yeah, they're big, big dudes.
Yeah.
They do touch on the painkillers and stuff like that in
right.
the doc, but they don't mention any of the human growth hormone steroids kind of thing.
Right. I mean, he becomes really, you know, addicted. I guess there was sort of a gap in time between, you know, they show him injecting things, which I remember that being sort of shocking.
That is shocking.
In 2002 or whenever this documentary came out.
Yeah. Is that when you first saw it? Was 2002? Was it right when this documentary came out?
Yeah.
Is when you saw it?
Right.
Wow.
And I had already, you know, I had already been a fan of the sport. I wasn't, you know, I was living in New York. I was too poor to buy a pay-per-view, so mm-hmm. I wasn't watching it every, you know. But I sort of kept up with it. There was a little store down the street on, like, 8th Avenue and 43rd Street that would sell bootlegged, you know, karate movies. And and they used to have, I can't remember if it was videotapes or DVDs of, you know, all these Japanese pride events and
right.
and underground fighting things. And,
yeah.
and so every once in a while, if I'd see something interesting, I would pick it up and buy it. So I was aware of who he was and had watched some of his fights, but that documentary just, it took you into a whole different world.
Well, I'm sure, especially for something that was not that much in the past was underground and then made illegal in 36 states or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can understand. Yeah, it'd be weird to, like, something that you're really into that you have to go to a bodega to get your to get your VHS tape or right. DVD
yeah.
somewhere near the limes, you know. And
that made it more exciting.
Yeah, though, of course.
Because when you unearth some sort of gem.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wasn't on, I mean, I'm sure I had access to the internet then, but I wasn't following any of this stuff on the internet.
Right.
So I wasn't a real diehard fan, but it was always interesting to me.
You weren't signing up for newsletters on your CompuServe email address?
No.
At that time?
I was not. I don't have a half-built GeoCities fan page dedicated to Mark Kerr.
That would have been amazing. I do, because we are doing this interview in Michigan, and I went to college here in this city of the zoo. And one of my buddies, Sean, was a huge Gracie fan.
Yeah.
And when he would order VHS tapes, I think in the back of a magazine.
Right.
And then
probably like a, you know, Black Belt magazine.
Yeah, exactly. And then he would call us and be like, I got the newest VHS tape. We'd go over there and watch. And then he would try wrist locks on all of us, which was always fun. But there was this certain element. And that was when, let's see. I mean, I think that must have been when it was no holds bar at that point.
Yeah.
Maybe 93?
Before what they call the unified rules.
Okay.
Which I don't remember what year that was, somewhere in the early 2000s, where, you know, a sanctioning body instituted actual rules.
Gotcha.
Like no knees to the head and no eye gouging. Uh-huh. You can't put someone in a crucifix position and just beat the shit out of their testicles
right.
for 5 minutes.
Gotcha.
Which was legal.
Which is weird because older brothers do that to their younger brothers to this day.
I mean, it's an effective technique. It's
very effective. Were you the kind of kid that had a makeshift boxing and or wrestling ring in your backyard?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not a fighter.
Gotcha.
I've never been a fighter. I'm not even a sports dude.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I liked baseball when I was a kid.
Sure.
But I haven't watched a full baseball game in probably 20 years.
Not many people have.
This is the only sport I like to watch.
That's weird.
And it's really strange. I mean, you know, boxing once in a while. I like that Golovkin kid. I think he's really fun to watch. But still, that's a passing interest.
Yeah.
I don't watch every fight. But this stuff I will watch every chance I get. There's just something about the purity, and I know that sounds really douchey, but the purity of just two people with no ball and no, you know, equipment,
right?
Other than these little tiny 5-ounce gloves or whatever they are to protect their knuckles. You know, just deciding who's better that night.
Right.
And there's something I can watch that over and over and over again.
Were you? Was it more alarming when you first started and now you're desensitized, or was it the same? Okay.
Oh, I mean, here in Kalamazoo, my friend Rod, you know Rod.
I do.
He and I rented UFC 1.
Gotcha.
In like 1993 or 4.
Wow.
We were roommates. And it was terrifying to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was sort of funny in that, you know, the premise was we want to see which martial art is the best. And so they had a 500-pound sumo guy fighting a Dutch kickboxer.
Right.
And a boxer with one glove on fighting this Gracie guy.
Right.
Who looked like a dude walking down the street.
Yeah, he looks like he should own a restaurant or something.
Yeah. And he would just somehow wrap his body around yours and stop you from breathing.
Right.
And I just remember we would look at each other like,
yeah,
this is the most terrifying thing I've ever seen in my life.
I agree. I mean, I remember the same thing when I'd watch those. That's so weird. I think we were watching the same kind of videotapes the same year in the same town, but didn't know each other.
Probably, yeah.
But I remember the Hoist Gracie stuff where I'm like, wait, he's got a gi on. Like, someone's going to use that to kill him.
Right.
You know, he'd come in with this, like, bathrobe on,
yeah,
and he looks like he should be selling insurance
right
to the guy that's about to kill him.
Yeah.
And then he just like gets pummeled a little bit.
Right.
And then he gets the guy in a lock, gets him down the mat, and just like starts boa constricting him, like just into submission.
Right. And back then it wasn't so clear as to whether or not he was going to actually kill a human being.
Right.
Like, we now know that they're gonna try to prevent death as much as possible.
Right.
But back then,
you didn't know.
I mean, maybe I was just a stupid 20-year-old, but you didn't know.
Right.
That, I mean, and of course, that was how they marketed it, which is another reason that it's sort of embarrassing to watch it now, because they marketed it as this, you know, who knows what's going to happen. You're probably going to witness a death in the cage, blood sport.
Right.
And that was its appeal when you're a 20-year-old kid.
Yes, yeah.
And now it's just a sport.
Right.
But it still has that remnant of, let's see what will happen in the cage, man.
Do you think also it doesn't seem to have been tainted by like, oh, the judges are on the fix, you know? Do you think?
No, now it's sort of widely observed that the judges seem to be less on the fix as just totally incompetent.
Oh, okay.
It's sort of a joke.
Really?
That people, whenever a fight is not finished, when it goes to a decision, everybody sort of waits with this look of, oh boy, let's see what they're going to do this time.
Really?
It's such a weird, subjective thing to score, because it's scored like boxing.
Right.
Which is a problem in and of itself,
but
boring, and we won't get into that. But, you know, so judges are just writing down numbers depending on what they see. So if a guy, you know, double legs a guy and takes him down and lays on top of him for 5 minutes, he will probably win that round, even if the guy in the bottom was elbowing him and doing more damage. So you never know
That's
how
weird.
Judges are going to score a fight. And sometimes they do it hilariously.
Uh-huh.
I don't think they're on the fix. It's not like boxing.
They're just incompetent.
They're just pretty bad.
And if you tap out, though, then the other guy has won. You've lost if you tap out.
Gotcha.
Out. Yeah. And that's that's what you want to do, is make your opponent tap out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or relieve him of consciousness.
Right, which is
via knockout or
also the definition
strangulation
of most of my relationships. Right. So, mixed martial arts has always been. I mean, they talk about mixed martial arts in Smashing Machine. Has that always been the premise behind Ultimate Fighting, that it's always been this mix of...
Yeah. I mean, I think so. I don't know.
It wasn't just wrestling, right?
What's that?
It wasn't just wrestling at first.
No, it has sort of a tenuous relationship to professional wrestling, which someone more informed than I could explain to you. They're connected somehow.
Right.
But I've never had an interest in professional wrestling. Even as a kid, I never really... I mean, I thought, you know, when I'd be at the grocery store and I'd see a wrestling magazine, it would have King Kong Bundy's, you know, face just covered in blood.
Yeah.
Again, that was terrifying.
Yeah, it was terrifying.
But I never got into the, you know...
Yeah.
It was never just fun to me, like it was to my friends or my cousins or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there is a relationship, but that doesn't interest me very much.
And then, so it's weird. This documentary is a little weird in that it's not like a pure biographical documentary where they go, Mark was born in 1968 in Toledo, Ohio. You know,
I don't think they knew what they were getting themselves into.
I think they
wanted to find somebody whom they could follow for a couple of fights just to introduce this sort of weird underground world of fighting.
Right.
And then they stumbled upon a story of a guy whose life is just falling apart, and he's in this really codependent, addictive relationship with another addict.
She,
by the way, does not come off well in this documentary, his girlfriend. And, you know, he happens to be addicted to pain. He almost dies. He ends up in the hospital, and then he makes a comeback.
Yeah.
And you know, one of his training partners goes on to win the big Grand Prix that year, which was huge for him because he had sort of...
Redemption.
Yeah. So they really stumbled upon
it's incredible.
A better story they couldn't have found in that world at that time, I don't think.
I feel like some of the best documentaries are the ones where like the camera crew just kind of shows up and like, well, I guess we're going to start filming. And then just the world's greatest story unfolds somehow. It's incredible how that works.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think these guys, I think you're absolutely right. They wanted to follow him to Japan and just document a year. And they got so much more out of his life.
Right.
Because when we first get there, when we are first introduced to Mark, he is kind of at the crest of his powers.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know where the footage came from. I don't know if it was their footage, but they show sort of his first three fights. So I don't know if they just got that footage or if they were there from the very beginning.
Right.
But you're exactly right. And then... It just takes off.
Yeah.
And he's at the height of his destructive powers.
Didn't he win his first three fights in like a minute?
Yeah.
Like wasn't, like right. weren't they
like the whole, all three fights in less than something like 5 minutes
that's
total.
Incredible. He's like the
on Tyson. The same night, by the way.
Oh, it was the same night.
I think it was the same night. Yeah, it was one of those they used to do tournaments where you fought, and if you won, you fought the next guy who fought that same night.
That's insane.
Yeah.
So, wow.
No wonder... You're loading your body up with painkillers and steroids.
Yeah, for like $20,000. Wasn't like one of...
I have no idea how much he made.
I feel like they were saying in that Sports Illustrated article, like his purse, like some of those purses were like $25,000.
Yeah, that's insane.
That's insane.
To risk your health and life like that.
For me, it's just taking an hour or two to go to the gym, you know, every day.
Don't get me wrong. I would do it for five.
Right. You would fight in the ring?
God, I would never step
How
into
much?
A ring.
If I have a briefcase with $5 million right here, would you go fight?
For $5 million?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd probably do it for $5
really?
Million. Dollars.
Who would you want to fight?
I would want to fight the greatest grappling jiu-jitsu master ever. Because then as soon as he touched me, I tap... And I go up to you, and I take your fucking briefcase with $5
briefcase.
Million.
Right.
And I go celebrate.
It's got Monopoly money in it. Would you fight Dan Severn for $5 million?
Oh, you mean Michigan native Dan Severn?
Yes. He's from my hometown.
I know. Coldwater.
Coldwater, Michigan. He was Coldwater High School's wrestling coach for a bit.
Was he?
Yeah.
Did you know him?
I'd saw him once at a bank with a black eye. That's my only Dan Severn.
I mean, he's in the Hall of Fame, I think.
He's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, he's one of those pioneers. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, for $5 million, I would almost do anything.
Yeah, true.
But I would shit my pants.
Yeah, you would shit your pants.
Both before, during, and after.
That would be the best part of it, I think, them having to clean up your shit and blood. at the end.
I mean, now when you watch it, it's so much more, it seems, it's so slick, and it's on right. Fox, and there's, you know, fancy graphics, and there's that NFL music, and right. there's announcers, and it seems so much more like a sport
right.
that you think, oh, yeah, I would climb in the, and then, you know, when you really think about it, you know, a cage door would be locked behind you, and
oh,
you'd be
God.
In there with a person who was trying to
really
hurt you.
Yeah. But they're real professionals. So after the fight, that's the thing about this
doctor. After he breaks your fucking femur, at least he'll shake your hand.
At least he'll help you up, you know, while everything breaks in between.
Right.
I mean, that was the cool thing about this doc, because I didn't know any of this stuff. Seeing them hug and take pictures with each other before and after. And, I mean, so there's a real professionalism to this.
Right.
Like the woman in the waiting room when he goes to the doctor, and the doctor's like, what's up? And he's like, oh, I think I broke my knee.
Right.
I can't hear, and my shoulder's rotator cuff is gone.
Right. Right.
And he's sitting, and she's like, what happened to your eye? And he's just trying to describe to her, like, what the sport is.
Right.
And she's like, it sounds horrible. And he's like, no, we're all professionals. And she's like, well, aren't you going out there to just really hurt someone? And he's like, well, yeah.
Right.
Yes, I am going to try to hurt somebody.
A lot of what it is people have bought into the stereotype. We're going to show you the bloodiest, goriest fighting sport ever.
Look at it. One of those people that thinks that it is.
Yeah, and really, for a lot of people, it should. I mean, but.
Do we hate each other, though?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. No.
How can you go out there and do that in life?
Well, you treat it as a profession. You know, I don't go out and try to punch a guy's face in. You know, sometimes I have to.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Believe me, when people say that it's too brutal and it's too violent and I have to look, I get it.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm drawn to it so much.
I have been at like sports bars eating burgers or wings and looking up and seeing a guy just get pummeled and just being like, I'd rather just...
Not for you.
I don't want to eat and watch someone get beat up.
Right.
That just to me is like the essence of Americana. Just
right.
More ranch dipping for these wings and turn up the volume on that fight, you know?
Right. I don't watch like World Star videos.
Yeah.
And I can't watch skateboarding videos when I know they're gonna, you know, wreck on the stairs and break their arm. I don't like that kind of violence.
Did you see Dogfight, that documentary?
Yeah.
And what did you think of that?
I thought it was really good.
It is really good.
Because that's about the underground backyard brawling phenomenon in Miami, which Kimbo Slice came out of, which is probably a name that most people will know even more than Ronda Rousey.
Right.
Hilariously.
Yeah.
Because he, you know, he had a short stint in professional mixed martial arts. It didn't do very well. Just had a comeback a couple of months ago against like a 55-year-old guy.
Oh, great.
Knocked him out, of course.
Well, he was also, you could pick him in one of those boxing video games. You could be Kimbo Slice.
No gloves, no, just bare knuckle.
Yeah, and just like a cut-off jean shorts with a rope.
Oh, there's another one called Knuckle. Have you ever seen that one?
Uh-uh.
It's about the Irish tradition of bare knuckle.
Oh, wow. Do they it like the old-timey where they point their fist at the guy?
They all look like the Notre Dame mascot.
That'd be amazing.
No, but it's hilarious because there's rivalries that are, you know, decades old between families. And they'll, you know, now in the advent of you know, YouTube and the internet, they'll make videos where they challenge each other to in their hilarious Irish brogues, like, "I'm coming after you. You don't stand a chance, you effing retard." And then they meet on a fucking, you know, a dirt road somewhere in a field. What? And just throw knuckles at each other.
Does the winner get a shillelagh?
No, the winner actually gets if I remember correctly, like a big ass bundle of cash, because they all put up money.
Wow. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, look for Knuckle. That's another good documentary about that sort of thing.
And our hero here, Mark, he grew up in Toledo, mm-hmm. and we actually are introduced to his brother when they talk about, and he's like 5'8", 180.
Yeah, like long ponytail, one of those mid-90s grunge beard, like goatee type beard.
He was in a bar band and worked at a video store.
Right.
And then his dad, Tom Kerr, who looks like one of those classic Midwestern no-nonsense kind of dads. He's just like, it's not for me.
Korean War vet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Find a respectable way to earn a living, son. Yeah, exactly. You know, you could tell he had no support from his family.
Oh, yeah. Well, his biggest supporter was his mom, who died of cancer. Before this,
right? Well, she was a supporter of his wrestling career.
Yes,
I don't think she was a fan of the
what he did after
mixed martial arts. So I think he waited until she died of cancer in order to
to get into his
first fight. I don't know. I might be hazy about those details, but the point is clearly nobody was on his side.
Right. Yes. Exactly. And I learned from that Sports Illustrated article that he was part of the DuPont wrestling.
Yeah, Foxcatcher. Did you see that?
Foxcatcher. I did not see that movie, but he was part of that. And after he shot Schultz, most of those, I think all of the wrestlers took off. They were like, we don't want to be a part of this. We don't want his money to help us. But Kerr stayed. He was the only one that stayed with the Foxcatcher and was represented by the Foxcatcher.
Oh, I didn't know. Yeah, I guess he was probably... I mean, you know, what are your options?
None. Yeah. Right? And a lot of people said, we don't blame him. You need money. You know, it's just, you got to do what
you got to do. When you're a world-class wrestler, and I don't know that he was a world-class wrestler. I don't think he ever wrestled in the Olympics. But, you know, he had the potential to do something like that, maybe.
Yeah.
And that's why he was at the Foxcatcher thing, which is, you know, John DuPont, nut job and heir to the DuPont fortune. John DuPont set up a facility on his ranch or whatever to train wrestlers. He's wanted to be a part of that world so badly, and he wanted to lead people to, and I say lead with quotation marks because he didn't really have any expertise or knowledge.
Just money,
to, you know, Olympic gold, and, you know, ended up shooting one of the wrestlers on his team. Yeah, and I guess so everybody took off. Kerr stayed there, you say?
Yeah, he stayed there and kept training and then wrestled under the Foxcatcher name. I believe he was the only one.
Wow, they don't mention that in the...
No, they don't. That's kind of what I was saying. It's like, but like you were illuminating. It's like this was just kind of like they just took the curtain away for like a year, and they don't really go back into Kerr's life, and they don't ever... They also don't... Well, I guess there's no epilogue because they stopped filming, but like he had a pretty really, there could be another whole Mark Kerr Smashing Machine part two.
Yeah.
You know, like.
There should be. Well, you know, they should show his last 15 fights in which he lost
14,
I think 11 of 12 of them.
Right. Well, there's the.
It was just a quick decline. And you know, he's still wrestling with, no pun intended, with,
You mean grappling?
Still grappling with his addiction.
Right.
I mean, even as of, I think, a year ago, it was sort of a up and down existence as far as that's concerned. Mm-hmm. And when you leave when the documentary ends, he was clean and sober.
Right.
He had just gotten married to this girlfriend, Dawn.
Spencer.
You know, and he hadn't gone on that crazy losing streak yet. So, yeah, what happens afterwards could be a whole other documentary.
It's almost as fascinating.
That no one will watch and you and I will talk about for
an
hour.
Yes, well, this is part one of our interview then. because he gets... Now, he's addicted. Like in the Sports Illustrated article, they don't really mention... Is it just painkillers that he's addicted to? Or is it also alcohol? Or, like, what's his pure addiction?
Gotta be. I mean, I think it was everything.
Yeah.
I know he did a lot of coke and
was
drinking really heavily. And then, you know, they say he OD'd on painkillers. I'm guessing it was a combination of a lot of things.
Yeah. Well, in the documentary, they show, it was October of 1999. It's a black card. They flash it, October 1999. And then you see this other black card. It's like, oh, no, you hear people, someone mentioned that he had OD'd. It's his friend who wanted to be the best salesman. He's talking about, oh, then I got a call.
Oh, yeah, right, that guy.
Yeah, I got a call that said that he had OD'd on painkillers. And then we are quick pan to the hospital where he's laying in bed. And right. They're like, we're not even sure he's going to come out of this.
Right.
And then, like, you know, there's just a cameraman just, like, focusing.
Right,
you know?
Right.
It's so wild that that happened during the filming of it.
Right, and that they got there in time. And, you know, really, that's the – for me, that was the turning point of the documentary was that scene in which his old wrestling buddies,
right,
people who were not interested necessarily in his fighting career, just old friends, you know, sat down in the hospital room and said, look, man, you know, that was a real sort of intervention. And you could see it on it. He breaks down crying and he knows he's talking bullshit when he's like, you know, he's telling that story to them about, oh, I was on a sedative. And then in the hospital, they asked me, or on the way, they asked me who the president was, and I said Reagan, and they all laugh. And you could tell he's not ready to face that.
He is not.
And then they say, look, you're about to die.
Yeah.
Things have to change. And you see it right on his face. He sort of gives into that. And I thought it was a really, I found it emotional and really touching.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is a guy who knees people in the face.
Right.
You would think he was just a bulked up id who does yes. nothing but throw his giant hammer fists at people.
Right.
But here's a real guy who's facing real problems.
Right.
And facing addiction, which has got to be more fearsome than anybody he would face in the cage. And he realizes that at that moment.
Yeah.
And he just becomes completely vulnerable. And then the next shot is him throwing away, it has to be thousands of hypodermic needles.
Oh my
and
God.
Vials.
That next shot is, I actually paused. I paused it for a second when I was like, okay, I have to prepare myself for what's about to happen.
Right.
How much they're about to show.
Yeah.
Because you see the drawer he opens up full right. of needles.
Right.
And then dumping out thousands of vials
right.
of empty and unused painkilling medication.
Yeah. I didn't know how much of that was like steroid stuff or
yeah.
they don't make it clear, but
they don't.
Whatever he was putting into his body.
Yeah.
He, you know, that was his one of, you know, his first step of just getting it out of his house.
Well, they show that scene where he's shooting painkiller medication to his arm. They kind of make a quick reference with the camera to his vein that's bulging
yeah.
and already kind of purplish because of all the yeah. shots he'd given himself.
Yeah.
Like that's nuts, man.
Right.
So that's you know, it's crazy what professional athletes have to do, especially in a sport that is like this, where you're not even sure how much you're going to make and what your longevity is going to be.
The window's got to be just so small.
Super
and
small.
That's even for the most successful of the people.
Yeah.
I mean,
what do they make now? Like what's the highest paid? Who are the highest paid people? What do they make? Do you know?
I don't know because at least in the UFC, they don't officially release those numbers. But it's generally known that it's kind of laughable what they make.
In comparison
to the top athletes of other sports.
Gotcha.
Somebody might make $500,000 and you think, well, that's a lot of fucking money.
Right.
But they, you know, that guy on a boxing card, on the undercard of a boxing card,
right,
wouldn't take that amount of money,
right?
So,
and he's risking getting kneed in the temple a lot.
Not anymore. You can't,
all right,
can't
knee
people in the temple.
Yeah,
but yeah, the pay is not good. I mean, people win fights, and often the UFC gives out performance bonuses, $50,000 or something, and it's sort of embarrassing. Somebody will, you know, knock somebody out, and then in the interview in the cage, beg for that bonus because I have family to feed.
Oh.
And I've spent all my money on my training camp, and you know, it's pretty bad
yeah.
the way that these athletes are sort of treated. But they don't have a union,
right?
They don't have anybody representing.
They don't have
them.
Owners.
No, they have. There's one company, pretty much,
right,
who decides what they're going to pay them, and they
wow.
can either sort of take it or leave it.
That's great. And now, so speaking of like the I have to feed my family, we are then introduced to Mark Coleman.
Yeah.
Who's his trainer.
Right.
And I would guess best friend. It seems like they're really fucking close.
Yeah, I think they went back a long way. They might have been like wrestling rivals or something. Uh-huh. I don't know the backstory on them. I just know that they were training partners and pretty tight.
Yeah. Well, Mark went to Ohio State. He was NCAA champion at Ohio State, and Mark Kerr is from Toledo. So I'm wondering if there's an Ohio
right. I don't know.
But the Hammer, as they call him.
The Hammer.
We're first introduced to
which
Mark.
Which is just another way of saying a smashing machine.
Yes, exactly. Everyone has a different
not very
variation.
Creative with these no. nicknames.
Yeah. It's like, what? The mallet?
The ball pee.
I don't think that's good. Yeah. And so like we're introduced to Mark like at the lowest of lows for him.
Yeah, he was a champion in the UFC. And you got to remember at this time, the UFC was sort of flailing and not doing very well. And Pride, which was this, I guess, Yakuza-backed Japanese promotion, was fucking huge.
Really?
Like 50 to 60,000 people per event in these, you know, stadiums or arenas or whatever. And, you know, the UFC was sort of trying to find some backwater to put on their show, which right. at that point couldn't be shown on cable anymore.
Oh, right, because of McCain.
Yeah, yeah, right. Exactly. So
he's been wrong about so much.
Yes. Now he's probably a big fan.
Yes.
Yeah, so Mark Coleman, who had been the UFC champ and then went on the skid, this was sort of his big comeback. It's sort of the opposite track of
the trajectory
Mark
Kerr. Is, yeah, opposite, right. Yeah, which makes it so fucking compelling.
Yeah. Yeah, especially because it was possible that, you know, they both are entered into this tournament, and it's possible that they would have to face each other. Which, can you imagine if that had been the story?
No. That it was almost perfect, though, right. the way it unfolded.
Right.
More perfect, I think, than if they had to face... I don't know. I can't say either
because
way.
Because if they had faced each other, it would have been because Mark Kerr was successful.
Right.
And
true.
Clearly this was the start of his downfall.
Right.
And his struggle in his personal life contributed to that.
Right.
So.
And once again, it's not like the filmmakers knew the story and went back and got archival footage. They were there while
were there.
This was unfolding in real time.
Right.
Which makes it even more insane.
Yeah.
And again, why I love documentaries so much.
Yeah.
You can't write this shit.
Right.
But yeah, so Mark talks about training, and then they show him with his cute little blonde wife and his little cute little daughters.
Yeah.
They show this giant man putting a diaper on his little girl right. and stuff. And then she punches him because he's like, what does daddy do? And she's like,
right.
boom, punches him. And he gives her this look that I was just like, whoa, like, you know, because he's so big.
What do you think? He was going to body slam her?
Maybe. I mean, you could maybe a knee to the temple.
A little
know.
Roid rage. That would have been fun to catch on tape.
What are you doing?
No, I think he's another one of those really nice guys.
He absolutely seems
In
like
fact,
it.
In fact, I believe, I might be wrong about this. I'll check it afterwards. But I think he just did not a Kickstarter, but one of those GoFundMe things to get a couple of hip replacements.
Oh, wow.
Because his body is shot.
Yeah.
He ruined his body.
At 55.
And he doesn't have any money anymore. You
right.
know, he had a short comeback in the UFC when it was at the height of its
Do you think those guys look back and go, like, was it worth it? Like, what did I, like...
I guess, but I mean, who knows? Well, I started to say this earlier, but when you're a wrestler, when you're a successful wrestler,
yeah.
then what happens when you're done wrestling?
Right.
What happens when you can't go to the Olympics anymore? You're still in your 20s, and you're still used to training, you know, 8 right. hours a day or 10, whatever right. it is, and competing.
Yeah.
And that's all you know. It's all you've been doing for the last, some of these guys, like 18 years, since they were 4 or 5 years
right.
old.
Right. And you go into a bank and get a job, and they're like, what's your marketing, what's your skill set? And you're like,
right.
well, I can gouge an eye or two. You know, like,
yeah, exactly. What do you do with your life after that?
Oh,
I mean, I guess that one guy went into whatever he was selling in his
he
office.
He got the Bic Pen Award
I noticed
for something.
That. Yeah. It's very
which is very salesman-y. I don't know. He was determined to be the best salesman at whatever he was selling.
He was.
Which
you can tell he's one of those motivational type
yeah,
guys.
Yeah. Which is what it's, you know, it's cool that they have. I love some of the segments that they chose to keep in, especially With the Mark Coleman, these are my two favorite segments of this documentary, the Mark Coleman story and the Dawn story.
Right.
His girlfriend's stuff, which right. we haven't really touched yet.
No.
But the femme fatale thing, I mean, it's just too classic.
She, remember the girlfriend in Spinal Tap?
Oh, yes.
That's how she.
Fran Drescher.
No, not Fran Drescher, but David St. Hubbin's girlfriend. They're out on tour. Having a great time, and all of a sudden, the girlfriend shows up.
Right.
That's how you sort of feel when she makes her appearance.
Is she, I'm kind of getting Waiting for Guffman, I think, confused. Is it when she comes into the theater?
Yes.
And she runs up. Right.
And of course, David St. Hubbin's like, she's here. Yeah. You know, he's all geeked, and the rest of the guys are sort of giving each other the sign. Yes. Like, oh, fuck.
Here she comes. Right.
And, you know, she gets that treatment documentary, and I don't know if it's fair or not. Clearly she was really involved in his life at this time,
right?
And clearly they had a awful codependent relationship.
Yes.
But you know, Boss Rutan especially makes it sound as though she's sort of the reason that he
right
lost all focus.
Yeah,
and I think she was part of that reason. But, you know, don't forget, she was also in the throes of addiction at this time.
She talks about her drinking, starting at noon, going out to lunch.
Right, and they have a very volatile relationship. He talks about calling the cops on her. You know, it's not unusual. This happens all the time.
Yes.
But I think she's sort of painted in this documentary as sort of the evil enabler.
Well, I mean, they do show that scene where he decides to go back with her instead of training.
Right. He had just won the first fight of this tournament.
Right.
And he had a number of months before the tournament concluded.
Right.
And Boss Rutan, who had whipped him into shape,
right,
said, I think you should stay here. Yeah. I think you should train.
Yeah.
And he said, I got to go.
Peace out.
I got to go with my girlfriend and probably drink and probably do a lot of blow
and get into fights.
Yeah. And
she does. I mean, she did have this kind of Def Leppard cover band, blow kind of Bud Light sensibility about her.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Most girls
definitely, they were bad for each other.
Yes. Yeah. And it was, and so he got in this documentary, you see that he gets sober. And after he throws away all his bullshit and he stops drinking, he gets sober, and then he says that he has to call the cops and they have to remove Dawn from the house because she wouldn't leave.
Right.
Then they show him coming back and like cutting like some tree limbs with a knife.
Right.
And then he.
That's a really weird scene, isn't it? Like he's out in his backyard and he's cut some shit off, and then he gives the knife to his girlfriend, and then he cleans the pool. And then he comes back and takes the knife. Meanwhile, we don't hear what they're saying to each other. We just see it's like the cameraman was in the bushes or something.
Right.
And then he takes the knife away from her and she flips him off.
Right.
Well, that was so bizarre to me.
I actually made a note to talk about that scene because afterwards I was like, "What the fuck was that?"
Yeah.
It's one of those like spices that documentary filmmakers I think like to throw in to add to the storyline.
Right.
Obviously.
Right.
But it was just like, what a weird scene. And like the other thing I noticed was that this doc, it kind of lacks music. There's almost no, like...
Yeah. There's just like a really sparse soundtrack of, you know, like a guitar and a drum set or something.
Yeah, it's very sparse. And this obviously...
Sort of Dirty Three-ish.
Yeah. Oh, I love the Dirty Three.
This minus the violin.
Right. And the talent. No, I don't know. But this doc came out before that big doc stylization thing where they animate everything.
Motherfucker, stop doing animation.
Right?
I hate it so. I mean, I don't hate the animation. I hate that every documentary now has to have that moment it's a fucking cartoon.
Yeah. It's like it doesn't make it darker if you use animation. It doesn't help the exposition if you use animation because it's been overused so much now.
Right. It's very cliche now.
Yes, it is. I mean, Kid Stays in the Picture, perfect, because it was one of the first.
First.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that whole technique of separating an image from the picture with the background.
Yeah.
They do that a lot too. I don't mind that so much, but Kid Stays in the Picture was the first time I saw that.
And yeah.
That was fucking awesome.
Yeah. Well, he's great. And he also did the Kurt Cobain montage of Heck, which uses a lot of animation as well.
And was my least favorite part of the documentary.
Me too. Well, the whole documentary was my least favorite part of the documentary. I wasn't a big fan of that documentary. I don't like complete fandom docs. Like, that to me just seemed like this. And then afterwards,
It seemed like it was just sort of a, you know, Kurt Cobain ass kissing.
Kind of. Hmm. Yeah, to me. I mean, and I guess I've never been a huge Kurt Cobain fan or a Nirvana fan. So It just seemed to me like this junkie who this guy seemed to like. And, you know, the guy was just kind of a junkie. And He made this beautiful documentary for him. I don't know. Like,
well, if you ever read that, you know, when his diaries came out.
Yeah.
We have that. And I got it when it came out. And I read the thing from cover to cover, or read a book like the Charles Cross biography or whatever, then none of the stuff in the documentary was a real revelation.
Right. It's all been heard before.
Was a surprise.
Right.
The interesting part to me was just seeing the actual footage.
Yeah.
Some of those. And if it didn't have that in it, right, I would have thought, like you did, that it was just sort of a, you know, let's tell you how great Kurt Cobain is.
Well, we did talk to the Jawbreaker, Adam Fowler, about that. And that was a great, and I mean, I don't know what episode that is at this point. I think 5 or whatever, but it was a cool interview. But anyways,
Whole
different documentary. but so, the Don Spencer stuff was really interesting.
I'm just glad there was no, you know, animation of Mark and Don, getting into a physical confrontation and calling the police.
Right.
And, oh, thank and God then that thing hadn't happened yet.
And then, we are introduced to Igor, and how do you say his last name? Yeah. Vochenchkin.
Igor Vochenchkin.
And is he still around?
No.
Yeah, this was, I guess, a long time ago. So but he was like, at first I was like, well, he's a bit doughy. You know, I'm not sure. Like, but apparently he was a really good fighter.
Yeah.
Because at first I was like, it doesn't seem like Mark Kerr would have too much of a problem with this guy.
I mean, you stand them next to each other.
Yeah.
And Mark Kerr looks like a superhero action figure.
He does look like a superhero.
He really does.
Yeah.
And then Igor looks sort of like a, you know,
like a gluten
guy who works at the gas station. you're right. He's a little
He's a bit doughy. He's a little doughy.
But, you know.
I love my vodka. But so then they show those guys fighting.
Yeah.
And Mark triumphs. No, I'm sorry. Igor. Well, it was a draw, right?
Well, here's what happens.
Yeah, thank you.
They're you know, they show them at the Pride sort of backstage getting the rules of the fight, which up until that point had been pretty much anything goes, including knees to the head and headbutts.
Oh, up to this point.
Right.
They show the point where it changes.
I don't know. Maybe it had changed before, but they're going over these rules. I don't know if they were brand new rules or not.
Gotcha.
In which you can't knee the head of a downed opponent. And so we cut to the fight, and it's sort of back and forth, and Mark's having great success. And then Igor, I can't remember if he knocks him down or just ends up somehow on top of him and knees him in the head very clearly. And the ref, instead of pulling him off and penalizing him for it, awards him the fight.
Which goes back to your previous statement about refs.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, this isn't the judges. This is a ref.
And, yeah.
But the Pride thing was always also a little bit shady. I mean, who knew what was going on back then? And so Mark, of course, is very upset about this and appeals to a guy in a hallway. I have no idea who that guy is.
Right.
But I guess he's in charge.
That's such a sad scene. The whole walk.
Yeah.
Of the elevator and the walking down the hallways.
It's his first loss, too.
And it's his first loss, and he's trying to find someone to talk to in Japan.
And there's a language barrier.
There's a huge language barrier.
Nobody seems to know who's in charge of anything.
Right.
He pleads this case to the guy. The guy sort of pats him on the arm like, I have no idea what you just said to me.
Yeah, he's like, I'm just here to get the luggage. I have nothing to do with this. And then he goes into the room and cries. Oh, it's so sad to see a big guy cry.
It is.
It's so sad. And to know that he worked hard.
Right.
And basically I feel like what the filmmakers are trying to say is this guy followed the rules. He's a nice guy, so he followed the rules.
Right.
Because he had gotten the rules. They show him in the room. Then they make a point of showing Igor's, let's say, manager or mom or wife, the blonde lady.
translator, probably.
Translator, maybe.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Let's just call her a handler.
Handler.
She's handler.
His handler stands up in the conference room and wants to be clear about the rules.
Right.
And says, so you're saying there's no kicking in the right. face.
Which is hilarious, because then he not only
kicks.
Breaks the rules,
right.
but nobody seems to give a shit about it.
Nobody cares. Yeah.
I think that's how sort of murky the whole thing was back then.
Uh-huh.
I mean, fights sort of went the way people wanted them to go a lot of the times.
Right.
And, you know, there's, I don't know if it's conjecture or if people have admitted to it, but a lot of fights were sort of thrown, and that was a whole different world. I mean, people still now watch the UFC and go, that fight was fixed.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot more on the line. I don't think they would do that sort of thing these days. But back then, it was just, much like the fighting, it was just sort of anything goes.
Right.
But yeah, that was pretty. That's another great moment, though, is to see a guy who was 11-0 in his career lose for the first time.
Yeah, that's
they just caught so many great first yes. moments on this thing.
And also, like, I don't know about you, but even if I had agreed to a documentary and I just lost my first fucking fight, I'm in a cafeteria room by myself, sitting on a folding chair next to one of those awful plastic. I would have been like, just get the fuck out of here.
I think that every time I see that.
Yeah.
I even though I know he's not going to, yeah. I keep expecting him to turn around and go, get the fuck yeah. out of here.
But he doesn't.
Some also, doughy Russian just kneed me in the face.
Yes. After I talk to his handler, then he's like, and then they like hug and stuff. I'm like, God,
yeah, they do a photo op afterwards.
Yeah,
and
he's so fucking nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just such a strange, you know, juxtaposition of being so brutal towards one another. And then afterwards, just, you know, it was like that scene in Jaws where they compare scars.
Uh huh.
Remember that when they're showing, oh, you did this to me. And they're sort of having to do it without language, you know,
right.
just sort of pointing out, you know, oh, remember when you cuffed me in the back of the head and
right.
I got this scar on my elbow from driving it into your cranium.
Uh-huh.
From driving. And they're laughing about it, and they're yeah. best pals, and they're taking pictures.
Oh yeah, and he shows them like, oh, that one hit that you had on
right,
my head was
right.
amazing.
Yeah, and you can tell through their body language that they're sort of saying to each other, oh, good yeah. for you. That was a great one.
I think Mark Kerr even shows Igor. That's young Frankenstein Igor, that he had like loosened his ear because he's showing him like his
yeah.
ear is barely attached.
Yeah, it's just a litany of injuries and contusions and scrapes and bruises.
Right.
The story of that fight was written all over their bodies and
yeah.
they were laughing and pointing it out to each other.
For a really gaudy 6-foot trophy and
yeah.
some money.
Right.
So then, there's some time passage, and then we see that Mark Coleman comes up to him and says, you know, good fight, keep your chin up. And then Mark continues.
Yeah, it was part of that same tournament.
Pride 2000.
Right. The Heavyweight Grand Prix, I think is what it was called.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Coleman wins his fight and advances. Mark Kerr, of course, loses his fight because he hadn't been training again.
Right.
You know he was doing a lot of drugs, even though they don't show that, because I think he's just, you know, except for that weird scene in the backyard, they're just sort of not around for
right.
for that time.
And Mark Kerr fights someone named Ensign.
All right. Maybe I might be fast forwarding. I don't remember.
Well, the guy,
because he won his fight against Ensign anyway, didn't he?
He won that fight.
He won that fight.
Right.
And then we cut to a few months later.
Right.
When he should have been training and he's not.
He's not, right.
And he loses his next fight.
Yes. Against the
And Mark Coleman wins his fight. So
yes.
Now we're backstage.
Yeah.
And Kerr had just lost because he said he couldn't move.
Right.
He just stopped.
Well, and then he says,
and this guy is just on top of him, just beating the
shit
out of him.
At one point, he kind of like stops and just kind of surveys his, you know, Mark Kerr's body, like, oh, I guess I could punch
right.
him here.
I guess I'll move over here.
Yeah.
Ooh, this seems like a meaty spot.
This is yeah. awfully meaty.
Right. And Mark Kerr's not
doing
anything.
Right.
And I think I think it was a combination of a lot of things.
He says in that Sports Illustrated article that he had done so much steroids and painkillers, he couldn't move.
Right.
Like he couldn't pick up his arm or anything.
Right.
Like he was so...
Just sapped all of his cardiovascular ability.
Yep, and sugar. Like apparently he would not eat before matches, but he'd eat a lot of candy.
Right.
Because steroid stuff zaps your body of sugar.
Right.
And he was just basically paralyzed in the
ring.
Sounds
like a healthy training regimen.
It's also my training regimen.
Steroids and Kit Kats.
Yes. Yes.
Now let's fight.
Now let's fight.
But you could just see it in his face. He just stops. There's,
yeah.
There's nothing left.
What were you doing when you watched it? Were you just like, get the fuck up? Like, I was just like,
I don't remember. But yeah, right? I mean, I was rooting for him, obviously.
Yeah.
But... Yeah.
I'm like, don't let the blonde-haired Japanese guy with the tips, the like blonde
frosted tips.
Frosted tips, the Guy Fieri of Japan, like take you down. But it's so beautiful in its sadness when you're watching that, and then Boss Rutan comes up to him when he's laying on the floor, and he's like, do I need stitches afterwards? And he's all pummeled and looking horrible. And it's such a sad moment for such a big ass gladiator type.
And you want Boss Rutan, who was sort of acting as his trainer at that time, you wanted him to say, sort of, you see?
Yeah.
You maybe should have come with me and trained for this fight.
There's some redemption there.
But, you know, I guess you don't say that to a guy who just got his head beat in for 15, 20 minutes.
Right. Give him a couple minutes.
So he says, hey, look, happens to everybody.
Yeah.
I'm going to run.
Yeah. Then he changes his shirt and goes on TV.
Yeah.
That was a great part. He's like, I got this other thing I got to do.
Right. You got to love Boss Rutan.
And then was he a big player? I mean, champion?
Well, he was one of those early pioneers too. Yeah. Champion, UFC champion. And now he's a commentator and he's sort of hilariously bad at it.
Gotcha.
But he's funny as hell.
Like the Reggie Miller of the NBA.
And just a giant personality.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Then we see Mark go in for his title fight. And then just...
Against Igor Vochanchin.
Yes, against Igor. And there's a moment where, like, he's got Igor in the corner of the ring, like, in this weird crab position.
Right.
Where he's got his half... Like, Mark Colbin has half his body in between his legs and is just... forcing his head back and then also then punching him.
Right. And you see him tap.
Yeah.
Tap out. Not to a submission hold, but to just getting his face beat in.
Just getting it beaten up by this Mark Coleman character who went from a loser when we first meet him to now winning this entire thing.
Yep.
And the other beautiful moment. It's again, how did they get this? When that, I can't remember his name. I think it was like a Hispanic name, but his partner in the pool.
They're
making fun of Mark Coleman.
Right.
And they're saying, oh, I've got kids I've got to feed.
Right.
You know, and they're all laughing and they're splashing and making fun of him.
Yes.
And then Mark Coleman beats that guy's ass.
Right.
And then you see this dejected look in the next scene.
Yeah, as he's leaning against the wall or whatever.
Yeah.
Because all those guys would hang out in the same area.
Yeah.
Like before they fought each other.
Right.
And they would come back and they'd still be in the same room.
Right.
Strangely.
Odd stuff.
Yeah.
Well, it just like there's, it's one of those, you know, you're in the entertainment business. You know that there's this weird glamour part of it. And then as soon as the lights and the audience go away, it's just a bunch of like fat union guys eating sandwiches backstage.
Right.
It's, you know, it's a lot of like garbage cans that need to be emptied. You know, there's like nothing glamorous.
Sweeping the,
about the other side of that kind of life. You know, and that's what you've shown is like, there's 60,000 screaming fans and beautiful Japanese girls that are introducing each fight and lights and cameras and money, but like backstage it's just a bunch of folding chairs and sweaty guys just hanging out, you know, and watching each other kick and do things.
Half of them, you know, still pumped up and happy, and the other half just depressed and leaning against walls.
Well, I think it's Mark Coleman that says, when you win, they talk to you differently. When you lose, they talk to you differently.
Yeah, you're right. And then they show the shot of the guy who just lost.
Yes.
And it's true. Nobody's around him.
No.
He's by himself.
Yes.
Well, you know, his dreams have just been evaporated.
Completely. And I know that from being a comedian, when you have a great set, people want to tap your shoulder. They want to talk to you. They want to come around and talk. And when you have a horrible set, there is nobody around. Nobody even wants to be near you because that they think it just rubs off, you know.
You'll get him next time.
Yeah, you'll get him next time, Bucky.
Nice try.
So overall, like, what did you take away? I mean, was there anything you took away from this documentary as far as, like, you know, philosophically, or like, what was your takeaway from this?
I just thought it was a really beautiful story of a guy that any normal person would look at, especially knowing what he does for a living, and just, you know, be filled with fear and awe at this guy. And then when you strip all that bullshit away, strip away what he does for a living, what his body looks like, you just see a guy who's like the rest of us, and who has trouble at home and has trouble in his head, and, you know, things don't always go his way. And it was just a great human interest sort of story. It wasn't about fighting. I mean, that's what got me interested in the documentary to begin with. But in the end, and the reason I can watch it again and again, is just his story.
Right.
So
it's fascinating. I mean, I'm really glad that you suggested this, because I, A, probably never would have watched it, and B, or heard of it.
Right.
You know, and
yeah, it's not on iTunes or Netflix for some reason. So anybody who is listening to this who now wants to see it, sorry. You can find it, as we said earlier, but it's not the most accessible thing in the world.
No, and it was HBO, so maybe someday HBO may replay it or whatever. But it is pretty fascinating, and you can find it pretty easily online. But like, I love docs that are slices of Americana kind of stuff, and especially the ones where they basically are peeling away a curtain and make, because again, it's not archival footage. It's they were just there,
right,
and this stuff unfolded, which is pretty incredible stuff.
Yeah.
So one of the ways I end these talks is I ask, what was one of the first documentaries that got you into watching documentaries? And what would you suggest as a documentary?
What was one of the first documentaries I watched? I liked all those Maisel's Brothers documentaries. Salesman.
Right.
And Gimme Shelter, right? Wasn't that one of theirs?
Gimme Shelter, yes.
I loved Gimme Shelter.
Gimme Shelter.
In fact, that was one of the ones when you asked me if I wanted to do this that I thought about.
Because
that's another one I can just watch over and
over
again.
That one's incredible. Have you seen Cocksucker Blues?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a VHS copy downstairs.
Of course you do.
I do. I bought it on the streets of New York in like 1997 or something.
Were you just thrilled? Because when I first found it at video store in San Francisco, I was so excited because I'd only heard about it.
Right. It was sort of the legendary, want to watch Keith Richards stick a needle into his vein.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Salesman's come up a couple times in these interviews. It's pretty interesting because I find that one to be fascinating as well.
Yeah. Oh, and Don't Look Back, I thought was that the one? The Dylan one?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was a great one. Those are the sort of ones I can remember watching once I was out on my own as a human being. And I'll tell you what you can never go wrong with are those goddamn Ken Burns documentaries.
Okay.
I just rewatched The Civil War and Baseball back-to-back.
Wow.
Like 40 trillion hours worth of Civil War and Baseball.
Right.
And I never get tired of those things.
Right. But you don't watch baseball.
I don't hate baseball, and I used to love baseball.
Okay.
And, you know, this only goes up to like 1990 or something, so it's more about the history and how well done the documentaries are.
Well, and you also are seeing a pioneer of a certain style when you watch the Civil War one. You realize this spawned so many other documentary filmmakers to use that style.
Right.
That Ken Burns fucking... I mean, it's so... Now that iMovie, if you make a home movie on an iMovie, it has like Ken Burns style, you know, and your pictures will like pan in and pan out. And
I did a... I was involved, and a friend of mine did a fake Ken Burns documentary called Pillow Fighter. I have no idea if it exists in the world or if he has the only copy of it. Maybe it's on YouTube.
What's his name?
Jamie Greenberg. And he wanted to do a Ken Burns style documentary about the advent and popularity at, I guess it was sort of the turn of the century, or maybe the early or the late 19th century, the sport of pillow fighting.
Nice.
And he, the reason it's great is because he wrote it so well in that style,
nice.
You know, with the voiceover and the music in the background and the, and the panning of a picture.
Right. Did they, did he do the letters like Dear Mom?
Oh,
the pillow fought.
Yeah, yeah. There's a series of letters in which a husband and a wife are writing back and forth to one another, and it becomes just a domestic argument about him fixing the screen door or something. I don't remember exactly, but it gets more inane and more inane as, you know, the letters go back and forth. And it's really funny. And I wrote a song for it as though it, I was unearthing, you know, a great paean to the greatest pillow fighter of all time. You know, so a song from the, you know, late 19th century or something. But I love that Ken Burns style.
Yeah.
I wish he made more movies.
Did you see the National Parks one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one's pretty spectacular.
I just started, it's not Ken Burns made, but it's produced by him. It's The History of the West in the United States.
Nice.
And I think that's maybe the only one I haven't seen.
I love Shelby Foote.
He's the best.
He is the best. I really would love to have a bourbon or two with Shelby Foote.
I think he's dead.
Well,
but
it still would have been cool. Now it would be weird.
But yeah, you imagine the stories that guy has?
Yeah, no.
I don't know. If somehow this gets back to him and he's alive, I apologize.
Right.
But I thought I heard that he died.
The rumors of his death have been greatly exaggerated by Stephen Lynch.
Yeah, Shelby Foote and Buck O'Neill, who was the guy from the baseball documentary who played in the Negro Leagues.
Uh-huh.
Those were the two sort of superstars that came out of those you know, mid-90s Ken Burns.
Yeah.
I mean, just two guys with hilarious stories and great personalities.
Right. So let's recap for a second. What was one of the first docs was? You were saying
Gimme Shelter,
maybe?
Gimme
Shelter.
Sure.
And your recommended doc?
The Civil War.
The Civil War, perfect.
Steven, you got a lot of time on your hands.
Thank you so much. This has been fun.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. You can find episodes of SupDoc on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please review, subscribe, and rate.
And you can follow us on Twitter at SupDocPodcast and online at SupDocPodcast.com.
This show is produced by Will Scovel, and our theme music is by David Siegel.
If you want to suggest a documentary or a future guest, please email us at SupDocPodcast@gmail.com.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.